And now, The Moment with Ryan Koppelman.
There is nothing but the moment. Don't you waste it on regret.
Hey, this is The Moment. I'm Brian Koppelman. Thanks for listening. And thanks for going to iTunes and saying you dig the show. And if you haven't, please do. It's great. It's a great thing for the show if you will go there and express that you dig it and rate it. Today's guest is John Hamburg, one of the truly great writer-directors working today. Hamburg's movies include I Love You, Man, Along Came Polly, Safe Men. He wrote Meet the Parents. He wrote Meet the Fockers. He wrote Zoolander. He's a genuinely funny human being. He's also a very deep guy and someone I've been friends with for a long time. When I first had the notion of doing a podcast, I thought maybe I'd do it with Hamburg, the two of us together. It didn't work out. He lives on the West Coast now. But I'm thrilled that he's here today. I'm going to keep this short so that the rest of this can be Hamburg and me chopping it up, as they say. Thanks for listening. I just heard that back, and I realized I said chopping it up, and that my son is just going to tease me mercilessly for trying to be cool, but I'm man enough to leave it in and take it. All right, Hamburg will be here soon. Are you here this weekend?
Yeah. Do I need to wear the cans?
Yeah, you can wear the cans.
I'm here this weekend. Why?
I don't know. Are we going to golf, maybe? Or are you familial obligations?
Oh, family. But during the week one day? Can you take off during the week one day?
I can try. I mean, I don't know if you know, John, but I'm not only a writer and director, I'm a podcaster.
You're a pod guy now. In between, so maybe finding, in between. I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, how's Levine mean, with this 11 a.m. slot, 11:30 slot?
Plus, I mean, the Vines, that's 6 seconds out of my day.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
So, but yeah, maybe perhaps there's a way.
Right.
When you're here, it's sort of an excuse.
Yeah.
You're not here that often.
No.
And if you're here during golfing time, to not play seems wrong.
Impolitic.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like
You feel like what?
I feel like we could play. We could get out there.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm not sure impolitics the right word. Are you sure
it's
that's the right
wrong
word?
It's the wrong word.
Because I don't really consider our relationship.
Unseemly.
Unseemly would be good. Mean.
Mean-spirited.
Withholding.
Yeah. I used the wrong word.
Okay. That's fine. John Hamburg is here, everybody. John, as you know, because you know the format of the show, I've already introduced you.
Right.
I've given some of your credits.
Okay.
And now, when you... thank you for doing this.
It's my great pleasure, Brian. Very proud of you. You're a natural at this.
Well, thank you. And as I said this in the introduction, when I first thought of doing a podcast, as you know, I wanted to do it with you.
Yeah, we talked about it.
As my partner. But it somehow didn't materialize.
It didn't materialize, and then you told me you were doing this, and I thought it was a great idea.
But I think part of why it didn't materialize is that you liked the idea of it more than actually thinking about really each week kind of going deep and exposing your real opinions.
I just felt like I didn't want to do that. I would just make enemies, and why would I mean, feel like I have a reputation as a gentleman. Why would I want to say my true feelings about other people's work, about the business, this, anything, for tens of podcast listeners to listen to.
Right. Yeah. I don't even think there's a number that would make it in a way worthwhile to you.
Three. Yeah.
No, I'm saying there's not a number enough. Like, even if you knew you were, you know, there were 100,000 people listening a week, I still think you wouldn't want to, really let people know what you were thinking.
Absolutely not. No, I was saying even if only three, I wouldn't want to let them know. It's not about success. It's like one guy could be listening in a closet somewhere. I wouldn't want him to know, oh, that's what he really thought about that movie or that dude or, you know.
Or you'd much rather do that in phone calls and emails.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then you'll do it for days.
Why not?
Good.
Send the cone of silence.
Well, this isn't that kind of show. And I think this all, the fact that you're here now and you've opened, by the way, anytime you want to come here, snarky, we can be or not. It's open door.
Standing invite. Great.
You were saying this room feels different than you expected it. What was in your head?
Well, my mother has had a radio program in New York for many, 35, almost 40 years.
Joan Hamburg, she's a legend, truly a legend.
And I've been to her studio, I've done her show, and it, you know, you're kind of sitting around kind of a triangular table, and the boards are nearby. This is more akin to a closet. Let's say
this is, yeah, I mean, it's
a padded closet.
I mean, the show business ladder, obviously, you know that radio, your mother's a legend. She's at the top of that field in New York and has been for a long time. But until podcasting, that was the bottom rung of show business.
That's right. That's right.
We're here underneath it.
Below.
You put the last rung of the ladder is radio. The thing you put the ladder on is podcasting.
Yes, yes.
The
yes.
ground.
Yeah, yep.
That's where we find ourselves.
That's where you find yourselves.
So, thanks. Thanks for being here. And on the phone yesterday, you said you had your inflection points and moments prepared.
Yes.
I mean, so...
I was kidding. My wife did ask me, she goes, I mean, do you have... What's the show about? I said, inflection points, that's the jumping off point. She's like, have you prepared it? I have prepared nothing.
That's fine, even though you've sent me 6 or 7 emails over the last couple of months with the word inflection points.
Well, I mean, because I like the idea that you hit that word, that phraseology, every podcast. I'm waiting for it, and then you go, you know, this show's about inflection points.
Well, what's another? I mean, I would.
It's perfect.
Yeah, if there were a better word, I would try to use it. But so we don't have to even start there. Mm. But I do think you've had a number of these moments, sort of fulcrums.
Sure, sure. Another way to phrase it.
Although you're an incredibly talented and successful person, I don't think your path has been one that's been easy and sort of as continually on an upslope as you might have wanted it to be coming out of college and film school.
Definitely. Yes. That is definitely the case.
And, I mean, why don't you take us back to sort of what life was like at film school? You went to Brown and then you went to NYU film school, right?
I went to Brown University. I took a year off, lived in my parents' apartment, worked, you know, was a PA on an MTV show, and did some internships and some crappy jobs, and then went to NYU film school. And yeah, I mean, for me, NYU, the first year was incredible because you're meeting all these people, you have a community suddenly of people who want to do the same thing that you do. And I was pretty targeted in what I wanted to do. So I wasn't searching for my tone, my voice. I mean, of course, I was trying to figure it out and get better at it, but I knew I wanted to be a comedy writer-director. So I had, you know, that voice and that thing.
And shortly thereafter, I mean, you, in a similar way to Doug Allen, not exactly similar, what you guys do is very different, but you had this moment of what felt like great success or pretty early on.
Yeah.
I think. And then, and that was Safe Men, right?
Well, first it was Tick, this short film I made.
Yeah, and so what happened when you made that film?
I made this film in my first year at NYU, Tick, which was it was meant to be like a slacker version of an Ivan Reitman movie. And interestingly, I've worked with Ivan later on in life and become friendly with him, and I always think about the fact that back then I was like, I want to be the Ivan Reitman of the indie world. And with these sort of high concept movies that are really about characters and not about the concept.
You couldn't count on his son coming along to be the Ivan Reitman of the indie world.
Yeah, I know. Who knew?
I mean, it's like, yeah, he was like, suddenly there's a Submariner pitcher out there.
Quisenberry.
Yeah, suddenly he's Quisenberry.
He's Quisenberry.
And where are you?
I'm a schlepper walking around the streets of New York while this guy's killing it.
All right, so you wanted to...
I made this movie, Tick, which was a comedy about two terrible bomb diffusers in a kind of low-key town where bombs keep going off, but in a very gentle way.
A gentle bomb?
Gentle bomb. This was before, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing,
right.
And before it was like...
Is this available on YouTube? Can people see it on YouTube?
It's on the DVD we made for Safe Men, my first movie. And it's it played at NYU, and it did great. It won some award there, and it got into Sundance. And that movie kind of jump-started my whole career. Ari Emanuel from what was then the Endeavor Agency, the basis for Ari Gold in Entourage, signed me off of that short film. And I was kind of off to the races and kind of not. I mean, I thought I was going to be off to the races, but I wasn't.
Well, yeah, and we'll pause the biographical thing for a second, because, yes, that the way, you know, you think about things and express them, you know, I was off to the races, and then you kind of like, now I held yourself, well, I wasn't, but I thought that I was.
Yeah.
And that sort of train of thought, that is very indicative of your characters, I think.
Okay, sure, sure.
Who are constantly, it seems to me, trying to understand where exactly they are on the map.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And reframing their identity a lot. I mean, is that something that occurs to you consciously?
It occurs to me consciously in looking back on everything I've made since high school. I was actually thinking about that on the subway ride up. I've basically been making the same movie since I was 16 years old. And it's about someone who starts perhaps a little meekly, a little insecure, unsure of their place in the world, and self-actualizes. And then kind of finds a middle ground, you know, screws up along the way a lot, and ends up a little bit better, a little bit more confident than they were at the beginning.
Yeah, because it seems like there's this battle between the conscious mind and the id, and you express those things in characters that surround your main character. Like, I was thinking about I Love You, Man on the way here, and then I was thinking about Polly, and in a way it seems like, you know, Rudd in I Love You, Man is kind of like your fear of who you are. And then, like, Baldwin in Polly is like, sometimes it seems like the way you wish that you...
Sure. That's 100%. Very well done, Brian. Yeah, it's there's the guy that I fear I am, which is Rudd in I Love You, Man, or Stiller in Along Came Polly, and the guy that I dream of being, which is just someone who speaks their mind. It's Baldwin in Along Came Polly. It's Jason Segel in I Love You, Man, who just walks around with a confidence and doesn't pick up his dog's after he poops and is like, why would I do that? It's natural, and doesn't care that people are yelling at him. He doesn't care what other people think, which is very contrary to my nature and what I've spent thousands of dollars in therapy trying to explore.
Right, because the natural man, your kind of like fascination with, not to get all Whitman-y, but like, you know, the whole idea of like the natural man and being that stuff. You know, the moment when Baldwin in the men's room in Polly comes up next to Stiller, who can't even pee, and Baldwin just farts.
Yes, doesn't care at all.
Which I can picture you in a shrink's office, like making a deal with him that you would fart in public once.
Right. It's, you know what? That would have been a very good idea. I haven't. The therapist did not pitch me that, but had he,
it wouldn't be a bad thing to.
Great
pitch.
Idea. Yeah. Just he pitched me similar things. Like, I have a fear of rats. He was like, my late therapist, who passed away at the age of 89, was like, I can't believe we're going there this quickly, by the way.
Well, I wasn't. Jesus, you led me here. I didn't leave. You led
me. He was like,
here.
I think you should stand in an alleyway in New York at 3 a.m. and just sort of let the rats scurry around. I was at the time, you know, in his office, I was like, that's a great idea. In my mind, I was like, there's no world in which I'm even coming close to doing that.
Was the dementia approaching at that point?
You know, looking back, I think there may have been some early signs, but yeah.
Right. But when so when you look at these movies and you think about them, this battle between, like I said, between wishing you could just be like the inner man, the id, and then somehow your characters, well, at least once in the movie, the guy does lose himself, the protagonist.
Yes.
Allows himself that freedom. But do you allow yourself, in looking at the movies, as you say, you're making the same thing over and over again. Do you ever take lessons from them consciously, sitting in a screening and go, you know, I'm going to tell people, hey, I got a man, you know, I'm going to tell somebody that I've, you know, jerked off, or I'm going to, like...
Yeah, let's go easy, first of all. But yes, I mean, sure, I think in subtler ways, I'm not screaming under the Venice boardwalk like Paul Rudd is in I Love You, Man, but I'm speaking my mind, being direct, telling people, this is how I feel. If, like, on a movie set, if there's a crew member I'm unhappy with, I will discuss it with them, and if they don't do a good job, I'll replace them. I mean, certainly, and stuff that in my early days I would have a lot of trouble doing, in those ways, I've definitely, you know, just worried less about what other people think and tried to focus on things that I want or that I feel and express them.
And when you make those decisions, do you feel happy? Like, does it indeed, in the way that it does for your characters, do you feel better having done those things?
Yeah, I feel sick beforehand and dread and anxiety. And then afterwards, I feel much better. It's never as bad as I imagine it would be. And I feel better. And I'm glad that I spoke, you know, my truth.
All right, here's a question totally unrelated to any of this, but I just want your take on it. Yeah, yesterday, because I just said the thing about jacking off, and I find the phrase jilling off to be unacceptable.
Never heard it.
Okay, good. People,
it's about women masturbating?
Yeah, when a woman masturbates now, people write jilling off. What do you think?
I'm not comfortable with it.
Yeah, it's wrong.
I'm comfortable with the idea. Whatever women want to do, I have no problem.
No, of course.
I'm
saying, but the phrase. Do you think it needed its own gender-specific phrase?
No, I think we were fine.
And the wrong one, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm not happy with that.
I don't want to think about Jack and Jill.
No. Jack and Jill to me is a delightful fairy tale or a bathroom where you can enter from two ways.
Yeah, there has to just be a better version of it than jilling off.
Yeah.
That's all I think.
Yeah.
You're the comedy guy. You figure it out. My instinct was to say maybe Jenna-ing off, but now you're in two syllables.
Yeah,
that's bad.
Yeah, it needs to be just its own thing, I think. I think you have to lose the word off so you're not even competing with the, you know, with the male phrase.
Yeah, it's its own thing.
Absolutely.
And sometimes, I guess, involving devices.
Yeah, why not?
Sure. Okay. Well,
we're done. Our work here is done.
We've taken this as far as we can possibly take it. So another thing that it seems like your characters struggle with and want to achieve is like a state of actual relaxation.
Okay. Sure.
And why do you think that's so hard in the world now to, I mean, you know, you specifically, but also why do we have so many different techniques available to us to relax?
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, to me, the world is just an uncomfortable place to be in. And I think most comedy writers, that's how they feel. It's just, you didn't grow up being the guy, even if you were popular, had friends, and didn't have a ton of issues, you still were sort of uncomfortable, or you observed awkwardness. And that, you know, you observe it everywhere. And so I don't know why now there's more stuff. Maybe we're just more aware of it. I mean, I think the world's always been a very uncomfortable place for most people to exist in.
Oh, totally. But it seems like now there's now the idea of utilizing all sorts of external stimuli, weirdly, like to relax is this giant business,
you
right?
You mean like meditation?
Oh, meditation, or, yeah. Yoga, soul cycle.
Right.
All sorts of ways so that people can have that period of time afterwards where they're able to relax. Like, I meditate. I don't know.
On and off.
You're on and off doing it. Yep. I'm on and off for me. I don't do it all day long.
You don't.
Okay. No,
but you have to do the podcast and the vines and
yeah, I gotta
you have
write
to write occasionally.
A couple of pages,
yeah.
Maybe direct something. So it's not a 24-hour
in
the mountains thing. But do you find, are you able to fully relax ever?
No. I mean, when I'm hanging out with my kid, I can sometimes, you know, playing golf once in a while. Not that I'm playing, I'm not in a state of zen, but my mind is off of the things that give me stress or anxiety.
Right, but you can get stressed. I mean, we both are golfers, and I agree with you, your mind is only on golf, but when you play badly, or like when you're approaching a 110-yard shot into an open green, you're fretting about it.
Yes.
Don't you? That's when I really wish I could find.
Yes, you're right. You're right. You're right. So I retract that remark. It's. But you're not stressed about things that might keep you up at night.
Death,
health. The you know your child being okay. Your relationships. Your parents. All that kind of stuff.
Right. So on the golf course, it's you're trading in a capital A anxiety for little a anxiety.
Yeah, for like a micro anxiety. And I kind of enjoy that.
And that's a good enough trade-off.
That's great.
Yeah, for me too. It's like what else do you do to try to get yourself?
I mean, honestly, I think those rare moments when I'm writing and in writing in a real flow state.
Yes.
It's great. You just, the time, you're not conscious of time or anything else other than the world you're creating on your laptop. So that is very relaxing for me.
I agree with that. The state of, when you have a state of flow, when that happens, it's there's nothing that, almost nothing other than, like you said, being with your children.
Yeah.
Your loved one, that replaces that feeling. Joe, who engineers this, and I were just talking about this before you came in, that those moments of, there's a kind of a peace to it when you look up after you've written something, right?
Yeah, and you're like, oh, I just wrote like 13 pages, or it's 2 hours have passed. Now, these are very few and far between, these moments. You wish they could happen on a daily or even weekly basis. But
every writer listening hates you. 13 pages.
Well, once in a while, I'm saying. I needed to qualify that just to say once very, you know, these are not the norms.
So those days you can get up and walk around and feel great afterwards.
I feel like that, better than almost anything else professionally, is the best feeling, because it didn't exist beforehand. It better than, I love directing movies, TV, whatever, but even better than that, you know, than a great shooting day on set is those days where you really write and you didn't even know what the heck happened, and you look up and you've created something. And of course, it's a mess, you have to fix it, but you have something there that didn't exist the previous day.
Yeah, that's the version of runner's high that people who do what we do get.
Yep.
Do you also run?
No.
What do you do exercise-wise?
I like where you're going with this. I do, I like to do the personal training. So I'll do a kickboxing.
Right.
I'll do a weight training with a trainer. That's, you know, a hiking up Runyon Canyon in Los Angeles.
Right. That's all, like on Ray Romano's show.
Yes. They enjoyed that. Yep.
They did a lot of that. Now, you run into as many models along the way as they did?
No.
Adorable models with adorable dogs?
No. They're there, though. I mean, it wasn't that far-fetched.
That was anytime Scott Bakula started walking up.
Always.
There would be...
Yep, in the Lululemon and the
whole thing. I was going to say that. Or maybe if it was one of those few kind of cold days in those boots with a little fur.
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah.
You would see that also.
Yep.
And almost like the bangs matched it. So, it's funny. Do you consider yourself an Angeleno now, because you live out there? And tied into that, do you feel included in that?
I mean, you know, we come back here a lot, and we are fortunate enough to have a place here. So, you know, I don't consider myself an Angeleno, but I feel like we're in Los Angeles at the moment, and I really enjoy my life there. I like living there. So, you know, most of the people I know who were in our business migrated to L.A. I mean, you're an outlier. You and Levine are outliers in that you do your whole career just from New York. Of course, you come out to L.A. a lot, but so few people have been able to do that.
Yeah, it's true. I think that, but you're, I think I probably wear the the identity of being a New Yorker is super important to me for
some
reason.
I've noticed that.
But you're such a New Yorker too, and like your family is so, because of your mom, you know, and your cousin, like you're very much a part of New York City. And I got to say, it was surprising to me when you really made the decision to do it. Was it hard?
I love California. We took a trip there when I was 10 years old. Right. And we drove up the coast, up and down the coast, my family, and I fell in love with California. It was just so different from what I'd grown up with. And so I love New York, but I like having everything be a little different than what I grew up with. I like the light being different, the weather,
sure,
the look of the people, driving in a car. I just, all of that I enjoy because it's so foreign from how I spent, you know, the first 20 years of my life.
Right. And I guess... because I grew up on Long Island, that the city is still amazing to me.
Even though I've been here
since I'm 21.
Yeah.
I moved here right out of college. It's still amazing to me that I get to live in New York City.
And I found that with people who didn't grow up right smack dab in the middle of the city. I grew up in Manhattan, you know, that was my world. We played roller hockey in front of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. That was like after school. That's what we did.
Roller hockey by the fountain.
By the fountains.
And did you ever walk in? You ever say to yourself, let's look at somebody's pictures?
Never. Never. Never.
Never.
Our graduating ceremony was at the Temple of Dender at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I wasn't the valedictorian. I was the MC.
Perfect.
MC well, of the class.
Well, when? So let me ask.
Tight 8-minute set.
Did
17
you kill?
Years. Killed.
You destroyed, right?
Killed.
Were teachers the targets?
No. No. Did not make. I'd made teachers the targets in previous speeches at the school, but I didn't go there this time. That time.
And are you still tight with the guys you grew up with?
Yeah, with several of them. Yep.
And is that where your closest friends are from?
Yeah,
or some from college and some from the movie business?
High school, college, and a few from the movie business.
Yeah. And do you mix them?
The college guys and some of the high school guys, or men and women, know each other. There's some mixing there. And then some of the movie business knows some of the...
Phil and Matt, Manfredi and Hay.
Good friends, Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi.
Phil says I would get him crying the second he walked in here. I could Roy Firestone him.
Wow.
He thinks I could Roy Firestone. You think I could get him crying?
I think so.
We have to make it happen.
Yeah, he'll do it in a heartbeat. He'll fly in just to do it.
I don't think I can... I can't Firestone you, I don't think.
There's certain emotional pockets...
I can't.
I don't think
I'll do it. I mean, I won't take you there.
Okay,
that's what I'm saying to set you up. So it's going to blindside you.
Oh wow, I can't
when
wait
when it happens. But I want to talk about another thing that I think I was thinking about language before. You know, you picked up on certain language that I use, and we talked about words.
Sure.
And what I've noticed in your movies is that the way people express themselves gives a lot up about how they think about the world, and in particular, it seems like people want to make themselves seem more special than they really are.
Okay. Yes, that's I think that's a true observation. Sure.
And is that conscious? Like when you're writing, are you like, you know, even Jeffrey Tambor's character on The Captain, whose character was on. What is he, the director of Three's?
He was you're referencing a short-lived television show I created. He was the writer of 78 episodes of Three's Company.
Which
or
he
Tico.
Refers to as
yes.
Tico.
Tico.
And when you think about the way Rudd expresses himself, and I love you, man, it's almost like a way to battle insecurity is to create an idea of an exclusive world that you are kind of letting somebody else in.
100%. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. No one's ever said it, but it's 100% what I'm trying to do.
We just had an Elvis Mitchell moment.
It was unbelievable. I'll give you what made me the thing that I thought of when you were saying that. It was a line I wrote for Robert De Niro in Meet the Parents when he said he's accusing Ben Stiller of. He says, "I don't want you messing with my child, and if you do anything to hurt my family, I'll bring you down. I'll bring you down to Chinatown."
Listen, and, one of the one of the great lines in a comedy in the last 50 years. It is known to be incredible. So go ahead.
So I remember writing that line, and yes, it comes from a place of this character who is in the CIA and everything else, trying, because he's feeling a little insecure, he's retired from the CIA. This is what's going through my mind, I'm saying, when I'm not totally consciously, but, you know, thinking about the character, that he's like, I've got to come up with some colorful phrase that's going to scare the crap out of this guy, you know, out of Ben Stiller's character. And so he comes up with that phrase, which is both sort of elegant and ridiculous at the same time. And that's, I think, you know, an example of the thing you're talking about. Paul Rudd making a date to hang out with Tom Lennon's character, Doug, and I Love You, Man. And he goes, I will see you there, sir. And I remember at our first meeting, Rudd harped on that line, which isn't a big laugh line, but he was like, he connected with that line because it's like using a formality to be like, I'm kind of a funny gentleman and I can use words like sir when talking about setting up a hang date with a guy.
Oh, yeah, that whole movie is filled with phrases, right? Where Rudd.
Yes.
Is trying to slap in the bait. You know, where Rudd is trying.
Jobin. Yeah.
Yeah. To. What is it? His own inadequacy that he's not the natural man and that Jason is.
Yes.
Makes him overcompensate?
Yes. He's not... Hanging with guys does not come easily to him. He doesn't use that language with women. He's actually much less formal and just himself. And then with guys, he has to use turns of phrase and call Jason Segel Jobin inexplicably, or say sir, or, you know, slap the bass, things like that. That come from a place of not really, again, to go back to your sort of uncomfortability thing in the world, and he's uncomfortable.
Yeah, and do you think that you said it was conscious with the De Niro thing, and I wanted to chase that down a little bit. So when you're writing, are you ahead of time thinking about how you want the character's mindset, like you said, kind of consciously, kind of not, like, you know that he's got to threaten him, and how have you made notes beforehand about like what you want the scene to accomplish, or are you just kind of writing it and then something in you feels like you nailed it? How much of it is intellectual and how much of it is sort of inexplicable emotional?
I do have a roadmap of how I want the scene to go. Normally every scene I there's certain checkpoints that I make before writing a scene, almost always. There's like four or five questions I ask myself about the scene.
What kind of questions?
I ask, what do the characters want? Or what's the point of the scene?
Yeah.
What do the characters want? What's the conflict? How does it turn? And how is it funny, if it's meant to be funny?
When do you ask yourself those questions?
When I'm outlining the story. If it's a movie or TV show, whatever I'm working on, usually movies, you know, when I'm outlining, and then I'll ask those questions, and then right before I'm writing the draft and I'm writing the scene, I'll really do a checklist of those questions.
Even on a rewrite?
Sure.
Because, like, I know that movie started with someone else's script, and then you went through it. So even on that movie, you were consciously running through that checklist just to sort of, that's your way that you stress test each scene.
Yeah, because it was a rewrite, so certain things existed and certain things I made up, you know, from scratch. So I'm certainly, in the stuff I'm making up or even stuff I'm rewriting, to clarify, well, why isn't this scene working as well as it can? There's great stuff in it, but could it be better? I'm sort of going through a checklist.
And does having that checklist then free you to be creative when you're actually writing dialogue?
Like, yes. Like, I do the checklist and I write little notes and this and that, and then I'm try to write and get into that state where I'm not thinking about those things, but I've sort of done the legwork beforehand.
I think it's really important. And that's exactly the kind of practical use that somebody who's written a whole bunch of hit movies and good movies, like, should be giving to people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's stuff that you learn. Like, where did you come up with that?
You know, it just over the years. I mean, I've read a lot of books on writing, not just screenwriting, but, you know, on different writers and the way they write. I've thought about what I think makes scenes work and analyzed a lot of movies and analyzed my own work, when I think it works, when I think it doesn't. And to me, I kind of like came up with that little checklist.
What's the process by which you analyze that stuff?
Do
you have quiet time when you think about it? Do you say, okay, I'm going to go and rewatch? Like, how do you codify that stuff for yourself? Do you write it down somewhere?
Yeah, I not that much right, you know, these days, but yeah, certainly in my earlier days, I would write a lot of notes. I would just type into my laptop, okay, why did this movie work? Why do I love Tootsie? Why does that movie hold up the hundreds of times I've watched it? Why does Spinal Tap work? Why does Fargo work? Why does The Apartment work? And kind of write down my feelings about it.
That's awesome. And did you then, because people want to know, I mean, this is, as a young writer, I know I would have loved to have heard this stuff. And as a young creator, I mean, I think it applies almost across the board in whatever kind of any artistic endeavor or many other endeavors too, which is taking a minute to do a personal kind of like inventory of stuff.
Yeah.
And you would do that consciously. Would you then break it down scene by scene sometimes? Or shot by, like, would you look at Annie Hall and go, how does that scene work? How did he shoot that?
Yes.
How did he cut it?
A lot. And I would do that a lot.
How? Like, you would watch it a couple times?
Watch it. Watch the movies a lot. Think about how it was filmed. Think about what the goal was, you know, directorially. Why did they film it this way? With Pulp Fiction, I really loved that movie. It took me totally by surprise, and I got the script and became obsessed with the script and the way he writes scenes, these long scenes, and then watch the movie and try to figure out what he was thinking, the way he filmed it. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And I mean, not by the way, just because I wanted to apply it to my own work. That was certainly part of it, but also just as a fan of people doing great stuff. You know, you just want to like go, what are geniuses thinking about when they make these choices creatively?
Yeah, I fully agree. Like that kind of curiosity,
yeah,
and fascination, and almost an obsession.
Yeah,
you wanted to do an autopsy.
Yeah,
I'm like, I'm hearing a version of being Dexter or something. I mean, no, you wanted to do an autopsy because it wasn't enough for you to look. You wanted to find a way to like taste it almost, and
because
touch
that's what we're all chasing. Like it's very hard to get there, but I think if you're in this business and you're not chasing doing something great, then it's probably not the business for you.
I agree with that. And there's only a realization I've had in the last, I don't know, few years, which is that for a long time, I would just write off Paul Thomas Anderson and Woody and Quentin as, and they are unimaginable geniuses.
Yeah.
But it would, by only thinking that they're unimaginable geniuses without really diving into the nuts and bolts of how they did it, you as an artist are depriving yourself of the possibility of achieving
sure,
it.
Sure, sure.
So you have to kind of go like, that piece of work is genius, but there's a lot of sweat and thought and calculation at play too, right?
I did that I had a laser disc of Boogie Nights. And I remember, I think I had the laser disc. And I remember watching this.
Great laser disc, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, watching this cut he did, I can't, it just flashed to me when you were saying it. There was some crazy way of covering just like a van driving away. I was like, how did he think about that? And I'm guarantee, let's say, I don't know Paul Thomas Anderson personally, but he probably watched a lot of Scorsese and did the same thing and was like, I love the way this guy's working. Just as Scorsese, nobody knows movies better than Scorsese, so he did it. You know, I think that's, I mean, I just would watch it and write down, okay, he did a wide shot and then punch into a close up, you know, and rewind it again and again.
So you would write that down and then would you go back to it ever?
Yeah.
You know where that stuff's written down?
No. I thought you meant go back to it. No. I mean, some files I have, some of this stuff I've written down, I have, so I can look back on. And a lot, I don't, and it doesn't matter. I think just the act of writing it down and thinking about it.
I've watched that craps table scene in Heart Eight 100 times to try to understand how Philip Baker Hall and Philip Seymour Hoffman have this like mano a mano thing over a roll of the dice in a sparsely populated casino in Reno. In
right.
And it's, I mean, you know, there's a moment there. You're looking in that moment at three geniuses working together at least.
Yeah.
And Bob Elswit, maybe four geniuses working together.
Yep.
The cinematographer, the director, and these two just titanic.
Great actors.
Actors. And you worked with Phil.
I did. I worked with him on Along Came Polly.
Was it scary at all to have a guy that, with that titanic level of talent? And intellect?
It was, excuse me, it was, no, scary is not the word. It took us a little bit to figure out, I think it took Phil a little bit to let go and to go, I'm in a comedy and figure out this character. And once he did, I almost had to give him no direction whatsoever. I mean, then it was just try it this way, try it that way. But it took a few days, let's say, and I remember the moment, apropos of the title of your podcast, when he became the character Sandy Lyle, this abrasive, brash, totally ridiculously self-confident and incredibly insecure former child star.
Was it on the basketball court or what was the moment?
It was on the basketball court. And it was like day three or four of filming, not day three or four of our schedule, but his third or fourth day. And we were filming this basketball scene and he goes, let it rain. He's meant to think that he's Michael Jordan. In his mind, this guy's an incredible player. And Phil was kind of low keying it and going, let it rain. And I was like, you know, Phil, you got to give me more. Cause this guy, you know, this guy believes that he's incredible. And Phil was arguing. Phil liked to work through conflict. He told me that, at least. Maybe it was just with me. I don't know. But he's, you know, I think other directors. And I like to work. I didn't like conflict at that time. Right. I tried to do everything in my life to avoid conflict. And I was like, just give me one. Just give me one and just go for it. And if it's not good, then we'll approach this and we'll figure out a different way to do this character that works for both of us. And he did one huge... He threw up a brick and he goes, let it rain! And we did this pushing on him. And the crew exploded with laughter. And I think Phil saw the crew laughing and saw that he could make an ass out of himself and be true to this character and... be funny and not worry, you know, just be free. And I literally from that point on, I think he just found the character. He clicked into the character. And then the rest of that basketball scene was such a joy to shoot. And he was brilliant performing in it. And his ad-libs and everything were incredible. And then it just, we were off to the races.
And then it was just the rest of the time, a kind of a pleasure.
Pleasure. And he and Ben Stiller made each other laugh. I've never seen two actors make each other laugh as much. Maybe Rudd and Siegel in I Love You, Man. But you know, it was incredible the way. And two very different kind of actors, different men, but just entertaining each other with how funny and good they were.
That must have been awesome when that locked in. How bad did your belly hurt when you were trying to know that you had to find a way to get him to a different place?
Unbelievable level of angst, because Phil was the only guy I wanted for that part. You know, there was sort of pressure to maybe cast a more of a comedy guy. Phil had never been in a comedy, but I knew him a little bit. And I just, you know, you have these gut instincts about casting. I was like, Phil Hoffman is the perfect person for this. He's the only person. And he agreed to do it, thankfully. And I was like, God, I'm not, you know, it's just not, you know, you feel it. You're like, I can kind of cut around the first couple of days, but it's not everything that I think it can be with this genius.
And so it's like driving you a little bit crazy.
It drives you crazy. Yeah. Well, and I'm not upset with him. I'm like, this guy's just trying to find it.
You know,
and
you feel your own sense of inadequacy.
Absolutely.
I imagine.
Yeah. I'm like, as a director, how can I help this guy get to where I think it'll serve this story the best?
And yeah, it just occurs to me that, you know, you've elected to make yourself a director, and you look at your movies, and I mean, you're so good at it. But in terms of the way that you look at powerful or cool people as an artist, you know, obviously you love watching people who can swagger, but they're also who have swagger and who are in positions of power, but they're also presented as douchebags, right?
Yes.
Or as really like. Hot air, you know, full of themselves, and along with, you know, farting and slapping another guy on the ass and jumping off a bill, whatever those things are that you admire about them, you're also pretty judgmental of their lack of empathy as a filmmaker.
Yes, yes.
And yet I imagine you have a complicated relationship with putting yourself in a position of power and cool.
Well... The guys that I write about, men or women, usually it's men, let's face it, in that respect, who have those qualities, they all lack self-awareness. And I think that's the key. And Phil, in that movie, as Sandy Lyle, has one moment of self-awareness at the end
of the movie, yeah.
Which, to me, wonderfully played and very touching, where he's like, I'm a loser, man. And he just lets go of everything. And
it's when he hired the crew.
He admits he hired the E crew to do his own E True Hollywood story. And exactly. And it's after this dad who never speaks says the one, you know, his eloquent line in the movie. And Phil sort of pays attention to that. And yeah, I think it's lack of self-awareness drives me nuts. And so I have no problem being a director, being in charge on the set, because I do think I just, you know, you're either born with it or you're not, have self-awareness.
You don't think people can, that's interesting. Why born with it or not?
I don't you think some people just are not self-aware? And, you know, sure, maybe through therapy or through having some messed up family relationships or, you know, friend relationships.
You think the tough, cool, popular kid in high school who, the one who didn't have empathy or self-awareness then... never gets it?
In most cases, doesn't get it.
Barring what, like tragedy?
maybe a tragedy or, you know, some kind of a wake-up call. Their wife leaves them or, you know, something like that.
And you don't think, like, deep down in there, they could be having the same issues that you are?
They definitely are. I think they definitely are. But they push it so far down that they don't really almost acknowledge it to themselves. And so they puff themselves up even more.
Yeah, it's odd that you and I both like golf because, you know, when you go to a golf course, there's only a handful of guys who aren't those guys, right?
And here's what I love about golf in that respect, because I can pretend when I walk onto a golf course that I'm sort of like a normal guy who's like, yeah, I'm just hitting a ball. I'm here with my buddies. And of course, that could be further from the truth. I'm, you know, worried about this and that and thinking about what people think and, you know. Golf is a sport with a lot of unself-aware type of people.
Yeah, you do. You go on there and you try to be regular and you know, on the range, you're standing next to some guy.
Exactly.
And, you know, you'd want to burp if he burps or something.
Yeah.
But you don't, but I know somehow, I mean, I remember once you and I were playing golf and Ron Perlman, the actor, was behind us.
Okay.
Do you remember or not?
No.
With a big smoke and a big cigar. You know,
yes,
Ron Perlman,
yes,
Hellboy?
Yes, the Beast. Yeah. Ron
like
the Beast
one of the great,
yes,
I mean, you know,
yes,
from Sons,
yes,
of Anarchy.
Yes.
And he was, I just remember you and I were like kind of these neurotic, like trying to play and be regular dudes. We maybe even had like a beer with us.
Right,
probably
right,
not.
Right.
And then I remember that guy just swaggering to the tee to kind of play through us,
yes,
and the cigar smoke,
yeah,
and his. And I remember him, I think he played through and he was like, thanks a lot, fellas.
Yeah.
And we just looked at each other like, what, frauds?
Frauds. Total frauds. And he owned it. Exactly.
He really was that.
Yeah.
That thing. And it could be right in one of your.
Yes, it's exactly that. I had a scene on a golf course in I Love You, Man with one of those type of guys. Who was like, guys, speed it up. Like that, he had a cigar. It was like that. It was probably based on thinking about Ron Perlman.
Ron Perlman.
Yeah, it all,
yeah,
comes from somewhere.
Oh, that's great. You could have cast Ron. You could have, at that time. He
wasn't available.
You
know, yeah.
Before of this. And do you still feel, are you now comfortable or more comfortable with the idea of, because there's another thing about your characters and I think about in all your stuff. I mentioned the captain. See, I think the captain has a lot of you in it, even though,
uh-huh,
it's only certain episodes.
Yeah.
Because it's so about inclusion and exclusion.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's so about feeling like an outsider and how all these characters, Al Madrigal, how different outsiders can connect.
Yes.
With one another's.
Yep.
Do you still feel like sort of an awkwardness of wanting to be beyond your station or place, of being aspirational, you know, no matter kind of where you get to? Wanting to be beyond it, are you comfortable with that kind of ambition as a now?
It's a creative ambition, so it's not.
Uh-huh.
It's I every day am like, you know, I want to direct my next movie. I want to make a great movie. I want to, you know, express myself and make the funniest, best movie ever. Of course, every day that's my goal. It's not, you know. When you've been doing this for a long time, you know, I started pretty young. It's not about like, I want to be on the power list. I want to, you know, this guy makes this much money. I want to make this much. No, that stuff doesn't occur to me. Of course, when I was younger, I wanted some of those things, just like, you know, everybody does when they're starting out. But it's about wanting to express myself creatively in the best way possible. Now and feeling like, yeah, when I've done some stuff that I feel isn't as good, it's a bad feeling. I mean, it doesn't drag you down for years, but it's like, oh yeah, that didn't quite come out as well what I wanted it to be.
I just want to go with this a little bit, because if you were home listening, you'd want me to, which is I believe you, and I know that the prime motivator is the creative. I'm certain of that. And I know how hard you actually work at that, and I know how rigorous you are in your scripts, and I know you're the kind of person who, there are a couple of different ways professional filmmakers go about doing things, and you know, you will send your screenplays to your friends and ask for notes, and you want them, and you,
yep,
want to get better. Like you, we, you know, we send each other,
yep,
our scripts,
absolutely,
and want the real difficult.
Yep.
One thing that separates a pro from an amateur is like the amateur wants you to tell them what's good about your script, their,
yeah,
script.
Yep.
And we only want to hear basically what's,
what doesn't
bad
work
about it.
Yep. How could it be better?
Yeah. I know that that's funny, but what can be better? But you do have, I think, a reverence for like old time showbiz.
Yes. Big
and
time.
And I do, my own sense is that you still want the giant embrace from the business. You want to go to the commissary and have everybody. It's not a bad thing. I'm just saying, do you accept that that's part of yourself, or can't you accept that that exists?
completely exists, desperate for it. Why do you think I work the way I do? 100%. Of course. 100%. 100%. Yes. Yes.
Right. You enjoy being wanted.
Yes.
Want to walk into the commissary. The studio president waves with a big laugh.
Yeah.
Some young writers scurry out of their thing so you can have the chair.
You want to be the
And then you invite them over. Yeah. Come on over and say, no, guys, we can all.
Of course.
Yeah, what do you think that's about?
What's it about? It's probably about growing up revering these guys, having an awareness at an early age of show business. I grew up, my mom, you know, as mentioned, is a broadcaster, and so she wasn't in the movie or business, but she had a lot of these people on the radio, and I grew up knowing that that was a possibility. She would get invitations to screenings that I could go to and things like that. But, like, being aware of Mel Brooks and hearing stories and the idea of Mel Brooks walking into, like, the commissary, like you said, and it's Mel Brooks. You know, it's not just like, oh, this guy did a good movie last year. It's like, it's Mel Brooks. You know, he's a made man, and because of his work, and because of his energy, and because of who he is.
And that idea of becoming a made man.
Yeah. Most guys like us would be lying to themselves and everybody else if they said that's not a part of what they want. But having said that, having been fortunate to have some...
You've had enormous successes.
It's ultimately... you walk into those rooms after you've done something successful and say, hey, this guy is, you know, he did great. And it's like a fun moment for a few minutes and then it's fleeting.
In a way, I think that's all true, everything you said. But in a way, I think I'll lump myself into this. It's even more like, you know, the thing Mazursky, I guess, does at the Grove, doesn't he? He has I think Mazursky has a standing.
Oh, sure, at the farmer's market, the table with all with the guys.
The table with the guys.
Yes.
And we have like there's a loose group of sort of like people who, if we were all in the same. Sometimes I think that part of the fantasy of it is the Broadway Danny Rose table. That we would love to be able to do this long enough that we've earned the right to sit and eat corned beef sandwiches.
Yes.
And just tell stories all day. And feel happy and content that we've done the creative work to deserve it.
To sit back and just be relaxed and tell stories and talk people and this and that.
To know that we're like in that. There's something about like finally being in. Like, do you feel like you're in the club?
I don't even know if there is a club anymore. I mean, I feel like.
Oh, if then you're not.
Okay, I didn't get the call. It happens.
I figured you guys my way of seeing.
How often do you guys get together?
I was trying to see if they didn't send you the skeleton key.
I'm not in the club.
No, if you walked in somewhere and you saw Quentin and PTA and... Yeah. No, and Quentin and PTA and, Jay... what's Jay's last name?
Jay Roach.
And like a couple of those guys sitting around a table. I was trying to think. Jason Reitman or Ivan Reitman.
No.
Or would you feel like, oh, I'll go sit down at the table and say hi to everybody?
No, pull up a tray. If it was Judd Apatow and Todd Phillips and Jay Roach, sure. Comedy guys, if it was Quentin and PTA, no way.
And Wes? And, Quentin, PTA, Wes Anderson,
you know,
Marty, you wouldn't go?
No way.
You wouldn't really feel, you'd be like, oh, I'll just go over there. I'm still not the cool kids.
I'd go, not at all. No way.
Were you cool? Now, you went to a really artsy and cool private school in Manhattan, but also like the most elite, you know, one of the five or six most elite schools.
Yeah.
Which if you say that to someone who went to his school, they're like, no, number one. Right?
They defended you that I said
five or six. I didn't know it at the time. No, I just, it was three blocks from where I
grew
up.
Were you cool?
I was not cool, but I was in the, you know, I was... funny, and I had a funny group of friends, and we were, you know, it was a smallish school, so we weren't the nerds, but we weren't the athletes. We were like just below the athletes because we could play basketball and roller hockey and stuff, but not at a level that was, you know, we could play varsity.
When did you know you were really funny? Differently.
Pretty early on, I felt like comedy was my way of expressing myself. Like when I was definitely, certainly in middle school, I was thinking like I'll be the editor of a comedy, of like a Lampoon, as my life.
Right.
As my life's work.
You thought you would do that?
I thought, I started the comedy magazine with two other friends in my high school, and I was like, this is...
Does it still exist?
I don't think so. The Dalton Lampoon.
So you started it?
I was like, this is what I'm going to do with my life. At that time, that's what I thought. You know, in that 7th grade, 8th grade, I definitely, comedy was my thing. I was obsessed with Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin and Saturday Night Live, and I connected with it on
that
a level.
That was your world, you felt.
That was my world. I think on a different than the average person who likes that comedy.
Did you think you'd write for SNL ever? Was that ever part of your dream?
It wasn't really my dream. I loved SNL. It wasn't really my dream. And by the time it could be my dream, I wanted to be a filmmaker.
So let's pick, in a weird way, because I know you pretty well, I know that the real moment for you is when your daughter was born, but we're not going to have to go there.
You're firestoning me. You're trying to firestone me?
Well, it's been a long time. You finally decided to do this. And, you know, I know how much you love her.
Yeah.
Boy, just think about how much you love her for a second.
Yeah, nice. All right.
No, but I think that, you know, there was a period where you were in the desert in Hollywood, which was after Safe Men and before. And what was that? Because what I get asked a lot on Twitter, you know, people, how do I break in? And really the bigger question is sort of like, how do you survive? Your movie was terrific. People love it now. It's been rehabilitated in the public's eye, I think. And it's as funny as you need to be with a great cast. But it was a failure. I don't want to.
Total 2 weeks in the theater, made $48,000 or $52,000, disaster.
And so take me through what that felt like for you and how you put the pieces back together and what was going through your mind to allow you to keep going.
Yeah, I made this movie Safe Man, great cast, and you know, we made the movie we wanted to make. It played well. We got into Sundance and it played well there. A distributor, for various reasons too long to go into, a distributor who shouldn't have picked it up. They did more artsy type films, October films, and
the movie failed.
The movie was a failure.
So let's pick. The movie, for a variety of painful reasons.
Got it. We'll cut. Yes,
was a failure.
Yes,
it's not an artistic failure.
No, but
in the movie business,
it
didn't enable you immediately to continue on the, hey, NYU, make a short film, goes to Sundance, Ari Emanuel signs me, I get to make a movie
with Reservoir Dogs.
Sam Rockwell and Mark Ruffalo and Michael Lerner in an unbelievable performance and all this stuff, Paul Giamatti, and then it doesn't do, Pacino, you know, that horse doesn't do what it's supposed to do. The thing doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And then where are you? Where do you find yourself?
Well, I find myself I had a job. So I did have a job at that point. I got hired.
A writing job.
A writing job for Barry Sonnenfeld's company to adapt a movie, a Polish action comedy.
Right. Now, I want to be clear that those first two movies you wrote and directed, the short and Safe Men, you wrote and directed.
I wrote and directed.
And you were a writer-director.
Yes. I did not want to be a screenwriter.
Just a screenwriter.
No.
And then, so what year was Safe Men?
98.
And what year did you direct Polly?
2000. It came out in 2004.
Right. So that's 6 years.
Yeah.
Of no, way more than 6 years.
Was
it 90? What did you say? 98. Oh, it's exactly
2004.
Not more. Exactly 6 years.
Yeah, 6 years.
So like, but 5.5 years of not being able to get behind the camera again.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. So you finish and you have a job as a writer.
I have a job as a writer, which was good, and I could make money and pay my sister back. She had lent me some money to get by, you know. But I didn't want to be a Hollywood screenwriter. It wasn't my aspiration. But I thought a lot about what do I want to do and why didn't this work? You know, and it wasn't a cult movie at that time. Cult movies take time to build up. So I was like, I just whiffed it. You know, what happened here?
And did you have self-doubt?
Sure. It was a weird thing because certain people really loved Safe Men and many people had never heard of it or it just went away. You know, it got a bad review in Variety or the New York Times, you know, didn't give it a good review. It got some great reviews. And so I was more confused. I was like, did I make a bad movie, a great movie, or what happened here? And I was too young to really understand I didn't have any distance.
Did anybody tell you the truth about where what your status in the business was?
Yes.
How?
Well, at one point, there was a movie. I'm not going to name the movie, but that I was... They were interested in me to direct. And I didn't want to because I wanted to write and direct my own stuff. And I remember somebody in my business life was like, look, you're basically where you were before Safe Men, you know, which is like at NYU, no money, no career, you know, only my aspirations and a short film that played at Sundance. And there's a lot of guys like that, let's face it.
And what did you do with that information? Were you talking to friends? Were you out there about it? Or were you sort of just... was it hard for you to walk around with your head held high?
Or? Yeah, I was confused. I had a weird feeling like I'm going to be successful in this business. I really never doubted that I was going to make a living in this business and do well. I don't know why, just combination of naivete and my parents telling me I could do things from an early age. And just some inner belief.
And you kept that going.
I kept that going, and I was working. But I wasn't doing what I set out to do, which is I thought I would 2 years later write and direct my next movie 2 years after that, you know. But like Ben Stiller saw Safe Men and thought it was one of the funniest comedies he'd seen in years. And so he and I started working together. So it was a dry period as like, I'm not Quentin Tarantino. It didn't come out. It wasn't Reservoir Dogs. It wasn't Bottle Rocket, you know. It was sort of like a very small cult movie.
But the fact that Ben was sort of like the beacon of light in a way, and he let you, he asked you to work on...
He asked me to work first on Zoolander.
Right.
Yeah. Ben and some other people in the business saw the movie and thought there was something to it, read the script.
And did you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to do this writing thing and build currency? Was it a conscious, like, I'm going to build up this currency? Or were you just following, like, okay, this is fun. I can make some money doing this. This is good. I'm meeting more people. And did that help you build your confidence back up? Because the act of writing an original to go direct, it requires an incredible amount of confidence, doesn't
it? Yes, it does. Yes. I felt like, let me meet some people. It's a good job. They're going to pay me to do it. I like this world. I like Ben Stiller. You know, he wasn't a megastar at that time. He was like a cool comedy person. He had the Ben Stiller show on Fox. I was like... this is like the most famous guy I've met up to this point. And that was way before something about Mary or even Flirting with Disaster, I think. You know, I was like, let me work with this guy on this Zoolander thing. We wrote some drafts not together, but he wrote some early drafts with a guy named Drake Sather, and they wrote some really funny stuff. And then I came in and wrote a lot of drafts, on my own, working with Ben as a director.
And that led directly to doing Meet.
Then Zoolander fell apart.
Right, it didn't get made.
It didn't get made, fell apart. I was like, all right, I'm going to go back and now write my next original. I was starting to work on it, just dreaming up ideas, walking around. And Ben said, I'm going to go do this movie, you know, called Meet the Parents. Can you come to a reading? And I think the script needs some work. The tone's kind of different from what I want. Will you just come to a reading downtown here in the city at Tribeca Productions, which I did. And, it was De Niro and some other people. Owen Wilson wasn't there, but some other people were in the reading. And I heard it and was like, there's some amazing stuff in here. And I think this tone could be different. It feels like a tone that's written for different actors and not as grounded as, for me, as I would want, because it's a very grounded premise. So I met with... I went up to Jane Rosenthal's apartment in the Dakota.
Beautiful apartment, yeah.
And Jay Roach was there. He had just come off Austin Powers, and I think maybe the first Austin Powers movie. And I'd known Jane Rosenthal's name, as like a New York producing entity and Robert De Niro's partner. And I gave them some ideas. I said...
Was De Niro in that meeting or just Jay?
No, thankfully he was not in that meeting. I would have been so intimidated. I gave them some ideas of how... I said, you have something really great. Here's my thoughts on what you could do. And I remember walking away and walking down Broadway and calling my agent. And they said, how did it go? I said, who knows if I'll ever get hired for this. But regardless, I honestly feel like I gave them some really good ideas.
Oh, that's a great place to come from. And then you got the call that you got the gig.
I got the call that I got the gig, and it was 2 weeks. I was hired for 2 weeks with an optional third.
Right.
So I started writing, started implementing my thoughts. And I remember handing in the first batch of pages to Jay Roach, this was kind of before cell phones were everywhere.
Right.
And was waiting to hear, okay, like, what did he think? And I just had this big answering machine, and I was like, didn't hear from him for like a day. And that, you know, talking about like the moments, I was like, it's over. I whiffed it again. I messed up.
So that 24-hour period was brutal for you.
Brutal. I don't know if I ever told Jay this. Yeah.
Oh, so, okay, so that period of time was brutal. You're waiting. You really feel like, oh, I can't do any better.
I felt like I did a good job revising the first act of this movie, you know, and he hated it, and everybody else involved hated it, and I'm done.
And how'd you find it? So what happened? Did you go out drink? What'd you do during that time?
No,
did you do anything?
Yeah, probably not. I don't know.
Just
no,
beat
I don't even
up?
Remember. I don't remember what I did. Yeah. Just be unhappy and anxious and depressed. And try to convince myself that, I won't get paid for that optional third week. You know,
yes.
I was sort of, at that point, money was like, I was like, I think I have 2 weeks guaranteed, so maybe I can save some money and write an original, you know, like
right.
And then Jay called me, was like, hey, man, I never heard from you or something, you know. And he was like, yeah, I had trouble getting through on a weird answering machine or something. He's like, the pages are great, really happy.
Then you were saying,
you know, I was like, oh, God.
So we're going to finish up here because we've been talking a while. And one sort of like technical screenwriter thing, which is, you know, when you say, I had some ideas because I was watching it, so I went in and told them the ideas. Just for people listening who have aspirations in the creative field, that sounds very casual.
Okay.
Like, you watched the thing, and then what did you do between when you watched the thing and when you went and met with them?
Okay. Again, this is pretty long time ago, but to try to remember.
It's probably still what you do.
Yeah, still what you do. Exactly. I listened to this read-through. I had the script, so I thought, you know, marked places where I thought it worked great, and the writer, Jim Hertzfeld, who wrote it, did some amazing things. I thought about it for 24 hours, wrote ideas down, was like, what's missing here, in my opinion, for the tone that I think these guys really want to do? Let's just freeform it and see what comes of it and think about how could this be better? What's this movie really about?
And you're actually writing notes down for as you're thinking.
Thinking
about
and
this.
Writing notes down. Yeah. And this one phrase kind of hit me that became a big part of the movie. I was like, I think there should be this private war between De Niro and Stiller.
Great. Yeah.
And that was, I was like, I feel like they should have this whole thing and nobody else in the family knows what's going on. And suddenly that led to the I'm watching you and, you know, the eye where he points at his
right.
eyes and the circle of trust and all these things.
All that stuff came to you in that little.
But the private war idea came. And then later the circle of trust and the Chinatown.
All were like branches off of that tree trunk.
Yes. But I was like, that's the idea when I'm saying I walked away and spoke to my agent was like, I think this private war thing is interesting because that's what happens in families.
And then you went in, once you had that kind of secret understanding of the movie in a way, your own version, you were able to then talk about it to them.
Yes.
In a way that conveyed some kind of authority because you weren't lying that you thought you had an answer. You genuinely thought you had the answer.
No, I thought I had an answer. I thought I had
valid.
An answer to make their movie a little more what I think they wanted.
So, what are you working on, John? What's like what's the next thing people can look for from the comedic mind?
The next thing, I'm finishing a movie that I'm writing with a friend of mine named Ian Helfer called Why Him? That is a kind of a Meet the Parents-esque idea, but it takes Meet the Parents took place at a time where like the patriarchy ruled, and this is a time where the kids rule the world. Where like the 28-year-old billionaires rule
right.
the world, and the patriarchy is—they're not in charge anymore. So it's kind of a reverse Meet the Parents
For you to direct.
For me to direct.
And are you writing that on spec or for a studio?
No, it's for Fox. Yeah. Fox
we hope
studio.
That'll be in production in 2015.
Hopefully, that will be the next thing I direct. There's one other one called The Sweet Spot, based on an article from Esquire, GQ. I can't remember. That I'm going to write after that. But those two are kind of the next scripts that hopefully will be, one of those two will be one that I direct in the next year.
Yeah, that was one of the horrible moments for me because, you know, as you know, I've had a movie titled The Sweet Spot in my head for a long time.
That's
and
right.
we were walking on the golf course, and you go, I think I'm going to write something called The Sweet Spot. And
that's
I was
right.
like, I'm writing something called The Sweet Spot. But it's yours.
It's mine. I can take
it's
it.
Yours. That's
right.
your title, and you know, because you came here. And, hey, man, it makes me sad that you're in L.A. because you're one of my favorite people, and I love getting to spend
Thanks,
time
buddy.
With you when you're here. So I'm glad we got to do this
me
now.
Too.
And I'll see you soon. And everybody, thanks for listening. John is not on social media, so I can't give you his Twitter. But
yeah.
he doesn't mess around with
I
that stuff.
I guess I got to start that at some point.
But I'm Brian Koppelman, at Brian Koppelman at Twitter. And thanks for listening, John. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Grantland. To hear more Grantland shows in your earballs, subscribe to Grantland Sports and Grantland Pop Culture on iTunes. Or go to grantland.com and click on podcasts.